Well, Washington produces lots of opinions about the nation's military power and where it stands in relation to what's going on in the world. Most of them lack coherence, consistency, and objectivity. That's according to Dakota Wood, the senior research fellow at the Heritage Foundation. He's come up with a deeply researched index of U.S. military strength just released. He joins me now with more on the index. Mr. Wood, great to have you on.
Thanks for having me.
All right, so what is the index and how did you come up with it?
Well, the idea was that here at the Heritage Foundation, we tried to capture in kind of a major document all the work on foreign affairs and military and national security and defense studies, so that it's in one place that anyone can go to and understand the context of threats to U.S. interests, the environments within which those conflicts might occur, and then the physical military ability of the United States to respond to that. It's the only document like it, certainly outside of government, but we produce it on an annual basis, try to maintain consistency consistent in how we assess things, and then you can see trends or changes from year to year.
I guess the question is, does the government in fact have that kind of thing, maybe inside the Pentagon?
Well, it's scattered. Each year the services come up with what their budget requests are based on what they've been told to do, but they're always limited by whatever an administration's particular policies are. You know, it's either domestic or foreign. I mean, there are all these competitions. So they're working within a limit that's been imposed on them, and they report back, this is what we need, this is how much we have, what we can do and can't do. And so we decided to take an external view and say, historically, what has the country needed to resolve wars in our favor, to establish positions that deter opponents from acting opportunistically. And that way we can do things and say things that folks inside the government really aren't, they don't have the freedom or flexibility to do.
Now, looking at some of the findings that you have here, you mentioned that for the traditional kind of posture of two contingencies at once, a two-front contingency, the Army would need 50 brigade combat teams. They've only got about 30 now, and probably only about half of them are ready, correct?
Yeah, one-third. You're right. It's about 32 brigades right now. They're down from 45 just a few years ago because of these budget cuts and the reduction. And about a third of those are actually ready to go off to war. So that's why we scored them so low. Not that the individual soldier, himself or herself aren't competent, but they just don't have enough in capacity to go off and do things. And when you look at every major conflict post-World War II, so that spans 60 years, the Army traditionally uses about 20 or 21 brigades to handle a major war. So if you wanted to have the ability to go off and fight a war and win that, plus the ability to deter others from doing things like we did in the Cold War, then they need double that amount for rotational replacement of combat losses, those kinds of things. And then we added about 20% because you never have 100% of your force ready, and you want to be able to handle pop-up types of taskings.
And I guess the same is true for the Navy. What you say it needs, 346 surface combatant ships. It's only got, actually combatant ships versus all of the ships. About half of that, right, is what they have.
Yeah, 272, 273 at last count. And every major study, all the Quadrennial Defense Review reports, the National Defense Panels, a bottom-up review by Les Aspin in the early 90s, and then, again, historical usage, says they really need closer to 350. We pegged it at 346. The Navy says, based on budget limitations, they'd like to build to about 308, and yet even within their own program, they only have 272 ships.
And I should ask you about your alma mater, the Marine Corps. Mm-hmm. How do they stand now in relation to what you think the country ought to have?
For several decades, they made 27 battalions. Because of these budget reductions and shrinkage, they're down to 23 right now, and yet the demand for Marine Corps forces is higher than ever. They still deploy aboard ships. They never stopped doing that. They now have special purpose Marine Air Ground Task Force, which are these crisis response units positioned in four or five places around the world, and they're on a perpetual 1-2 rotation cycle. So they deploy out for 7 months, come back for 14, connecting with their families, training, kind of getting a breath, and they go right back out for 7. It wears down the force, and they're really lacking in capacity as well.
We're speaking with Dakota Wood. He's a senior research fellow at the Heritage Foundation. Now, the question comes up, though, if the United States, say, decided to do this, and, that's a pretty big if, but let's presume that they do, the personnel costs, which have been mounting and almost multiplying exponentially, if you look at the life cycle cost of a service member, Can the nation begin to afford this kind of posture anymore?
Actually, yes. I mean, historically, as a percentage of GDP, it's been around 5.5% of GDP. Again, extending back over time, normalized for inflation and all that stuff. Right now, we're, I think, dipping below 3%, about 2.8%, 2.9%. The baseline budget has resulted in these loss of capacity, aging of equipment, the inability to bring things into long-term maintenance cycles, you know, all the problems that they're having. And this plus up with this new budget deal brings it up to about $607 billion, and that's just to stem the further degradation of the forces. So you actually need something north of that. Just as a reference point, if you went to 4% of GDP on an $18 trillion economy, that's about $720 billion. So by historical standards, the nation can afford the kind of military it wants. It, the priorities, though, have shifted more to subsidies, social programs, and certainly the driver of the national debt is not military expenditures. It's a very small percentage of what the country spends. It's all the other things that are going on. So it's really a prioritization issue.
And we've seen some pretty big moves by China and Russia. China, for example, moving into the South China Sea, building the islands there, and everything Russia's been doing almost everywhere you can throw a tack at a map. Do you believe that those moves might be in part inspired by the fact that they don't think the United States has the iron to deal with it if they had to?
Yeah, in power competitions between countries, you know, there's always kind of a pushing against each other. Nobody's really ever satisfied with where they're at. And so we have Russia and China both seeking to be the dominant military power. Not that they want to invade and take over these huge swaths of the planet, but when you have that kind of posture, then economic wealth goes along with that. People start coming to your side, you know, in these alliances and frameworks. And what you're doing is pushing out competing powers and influences that might deter or prove a problem to your own objectives. So Russia is moving very aggressively. China is moving very aggressively. Even Iran in the Middle East is moving aggressively because the U.S. has, in practical terms, withdrawn. We're there rhetorically. We're there with diplomacy and diplomatic initiatives, but that's just so much talk if you don't have the physical ability to back up those words. And that's what people really look at. I mean, you look at Poland, the Baltic states, Ukraine, others in Europe, very concerned about Russia's doing, and we have allies in the Pacific that are similarly concerned about China.
So what do you do with a report like this at this point? Because, as you know, there's no shortage of reports coming out every month, every day here in Washington.
Yeah, we realize, I mean, the sea is awash, I mean, in D.C. with everybody in an opinion. So we really tried to make this academically rigorous. We think it has integrity. We tried completely to avoid any kind of partisan rhetoric in there. We meant it to be informative. It's a snapshot in time. This is the condition of America's military. This is what's going on in the world. And then those who receive the report, members of Congress, the military establishment itself, and the American public, can, you know, come to their own conclusion. So we intend for it to be a conversation starter, a reference document, and then something that is consistent from year to year so we can see patterns and trends. And that's how we're trying to advertise it.
Dakota Wood is a senior research fellow at the Heritage Foundation. Thanks so much for joining me.
My pleasure. Thanks.